My name's Charlie Bartell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
I love the way we say that with pride in our voice. I don't think any of us are proud of being of the disease of alcoholism, but we're all proud of sharing the same solution. Now, I want to thank the committee, Jerry, and all of you for this singular honor. I'm always blown away with the privilege of doing this. It's just remarkable. I'm also blown away with your hospitality. No matter where you go, people are very hospitable. But it's apparent to me that you're used to this and that you were raised that way. And there's a difference when you come to a place like Cartersville, Georgia. And I'm eternally grateful for everything you've done for me since I've been here. Typical alcoholic, I don't feel I deserve it, you know, but I'll accept it. You know, the way we say that. My name's Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. I was sitting behind in one of the conventions about the third year I was in this program, and there was a couple of Earth people sitting in front of me, lovely elderly couple, and he leaned over and said, "You hear what he said, Mabel?" And said it right out loud, and she turned to him and said, "Yeah," and he did it without any shame in his voice. Well, that's the way we do it. We've learned to do that because of those co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous told us that we didn't have to be doormats anymore, and we don't. We get here from a lot of different roads, but we travel that road of happy destiny, that common solution that we all enjoy. I'd like to be able to stand up here and tell you about how I was abused as a child and how I didn't have any choice but to ultimately become an alcoholic, but it really wasn't that way. You know, from my earliest memory, I came from a very functional family. If there was anything dysfunctional in it, perhaps it was me, but I came from a very happy childhood. When I was born in Dallas, Texas, part of Dallas called Highland Park, and those of you that might be familiar with that, that was one of the first gated communities in the United States, had its own fire department, its own police department. Dallas's wouldn't do. As a child, I remember we had upstairs maid, downstairs maid, chef, someone that drove the car, had a yard staff. I thought everybody lived that way because all my friends lived that way. And I want to tell you something, it's not a half bad way of living either. You can get used to that pretty quick, and I did. And early on in life, I found out that the secret to living was to please the adults around you because they apparently had all the power. And all I had to do was bring home a gold star every now and then, and they'd jump through hoops for me and give me what I wanted. And I thought, boy, life's a breeze. You hear a lot of people say that they felt uneasy as a child and that they had a difficult time making friends and things. It wasn't that way with me. I just enjoyed childhood, I enjoyed early adulthood, I enjoyed everything about it. I made friends easily, I was popular. Things were just wonderful. I don't know what went wrong, but something did. But in going to school was real easy for me. I have a thing called partial eidetic imagery. That's what people popularly call photographic memory. So it was easy for me to bring home the gold stars. And that was my job. And I went through grade school and high school and just made straight A's. It was just easy. But I made it look difficult. I made it look like, look what I've done. I've earned this gold star. My parents, my father, he was an interesting fellow. He came from a relatively wealthy home, and there was an academic tradition in our family, and he had gotten his PhD in geology from Stanford, and after he did that, he set out to enjoy himself for a while. And back in the early 20s, one of the popular things to do was have these cross-country road races, and he'd enter one of these, and they start with the rear wheels in the Pacific Ocean and dash across, and the first one that got his front wheels in the Atlantic Ocean won the race, and there were no other rules than that. And he entered this thing and was taking a southern route across the continent and turned his car over in Shreveport, Louisiana. Tore his car up. Him and his mechanic weren't hurt seriously, and he wired home for money. And he got a return wire, and it said simply, "Get a job." he was faced with adulthood, I guess. And rather than get a job, he promoted a few guys together, and he went into East Texas and bought an old drilling rig and drilled an oil well and discovered the Hawkins oil field. For that, I'll be eternally grateful. That's Exxon Petroleum's largest North American deposit today. And that helped take the rough edges off. He was very successful in business, and when I came along, I'm the youngest of the family. I have an older brother. One of those things at the top of my resentment list, my older brother. He's one of those guys that took a lot of money and made a fortune. You know, you ran it into real money. He just did everything perfectly. And that's hard to live up to. So I didn't try. When I was a youngster, I remember my family had to do a lot of entertaining, and I remember the cocktail parties. They had a charm to me. I'd sort of slip around and watch these people, and there were all kinds of interesting people around. There was an old guy that used to always wear khakis and had a big floppy fedora hat, and he was I think intellectually he was about my age, and we'd slip off in the backyard and play pitch and catch, and he's just one of the most interesting guys, and we just had a good time together. Sometimes I thought he came over the house just to have fun with me, and his name was Howard Hughes, and he was just the most interesting guy, you know, and it turned out to be a bit eccentric, and I think eccentricity ran in both of our bloods. I set out to be eccentric, and I achieved that goal, one of the few goals I achieved in life. I remember my first drink. I had it in high school, and I wish it was like the experience many of you had. People describe that drink going down and warming them up and just opening like an umbrella, and that's how I remember my first drink. It had fruit and an umbrella in it. It had to be a serious drink. But I didn't have that same result. I think I got my alcoholism the old-fashioned way. I earned it just drink by drink. But it became important to me to drink because I watched these people at these cocktail parties. They seemed like they'd get a bit more gay, and their laughter would get just magic, you know, and they seemed to enjoy themselves and interact so well. And I wish that my drinking had stayed that way the rest of the time, but it didn't. Came time for me to go to college, and the family had the little meeting to determine my life, and they said, well, we'll send him to the University of Oklahoma to become a petroleum engineer. See, my father was a geologist, my older brother's a geologist, my mother was a geologist. All had advanced degrees, so I set out to become a petroleum engineer. Went to University of Oklahoma, and I was looking forward to this because, Bud Wilkerson was a coach, and first things first, you know, these Alabama folks around here and these Georgia folks will understand this. OU was number one in the nation at that time. Used to beat North Carolina like a drum, 55-0, things like for you North Carolina folks. They'd run 50 straight ball games, so I went up there for important things, and I set in and started collecting gold stars. I joined the right fraternities, and I made straight A's, and 5 years later I graduated. I had 180 undergraduate hours, and I had a degree in history and a degree in psychology, and neither one of those qualified me to do anything for the family business. So I did the only thing I knew to do. I went on to school, because that's what I did. I went to school and collected gold stars. Along the way, I'd collected something else, too. I'd gotten married, and I had two children. And I continued to drink, but I think at that time I would describe myself as a social drinker. And I went on. I decided to go to Harvard University, and I got a master's in mathematics. And then I got a master's in psychology. So at this point, I had 4 degrees, and what was I to do? I went to college. I got a PhD in experimental psychology. Now, along the way, I was fairly productive and fairly successful in doing things that you're supposed to do in the academic world. And I'd published 77 times by that time. That was remarkable. But I'd find some obscure journal and write some little obscure article and publish for publish's sake. I know when I was doing my master's research, and After I finished that, I got a call from, I'm sure you're all familiar with that research. It was effective ionizing radiation on bar pressing behavior in the white rat. Now I get right to the heart of the matter. And I'd won an outstanding research award with that paper. No one could understand it but me, so everybody thought it was important. Now, I'd been asked by the International Congress of Psychologists to go to Moscow and speak on this. Moskva. I get this invitation from them, which I quickly accepted. I could tell they had good judgment and wanted someone important over there. See, ego deflation at depth was very difficult for me. I went through about three sponsors before I even got the point. But you'll find that I wander around. I've got brain damage and I've got an excuse. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say next because I never know. I just wander around and have a great time. I envy people that have that set talk, you know. But I wish they'd change their jokes occasionally. But State Department notifies me. They said, we can't prevent you from doing this, going to Moscow. But the 63, the Cold War was at its height and everything. And all they knew was the title of my paper, and it had radiation in it. And they knew for doggone sure that this involved some kind of top secrets. They told me I couldn't go. Already I'm thinking alcoholically, apparently. I made immediately arrangements to leave, but it was difficult to get into Russia at the time. I went to Helsinki, Finland, and managed to get a overland train into Leningrad, now St. Petersburg again, and eventually made my way into Moscow, and I really enjoyed it. In order to go through to get your doctorate, you had to show proficiency in a couple of languages. Back then, the old academic tradition. At one time, they were Latin and Greek because everything that was published in those languages, and that was one of the hazings you went through to get a PhD. You had to show fluency in both ancient Latin and Greek. By this time, things had changed up. My two languages were French and German. I had a good reading knowledge of both of them, and that was all that was really required and all you were tested on. But naturally, being a good alcoholic, I thought I was fluent in both of them. I get into Moscow, and the night before I was to deliver this paper, they came to me and said, English is not one of the languages that we accept at our conference. Once again, the whole reason for that was that the Cold War was at its peak. And I told them that my Russian was a bit shaky, a bit rusty. Well, I knew five words in Russian, three of them for vodka. That's an interesting, you might be interested in it. They make 11 different kinds of flavors of vodka over there. Most people know what to do with that stuff. But I said I could give it in either French or German, and they opted that I give it in German. And I sat down that night and made out a little hasty little translation of that. Oh, I was proud of myself. I got up and I delivered that paper in my fluent German, sat down to sort of confused and muddled applause, and never dawned on me that they couldn't understand a damn thing I said. I just relate that because, years later, when I was near the end of my drinking, I was in a bar room in New York City called Sullivan's. And Sullivan's is not on your main tourist itinerary. It's really a bottom bar. And I was in there once again, had calls to use my fluent German. I was talking to these two gentlemen, carrying on, and you know how our barroom behavior goes, you know. I buy them around, they buy me one. We go back and forth and play these potlatch games. And they finally got up sort of confused and left. Reminded me of that crowd. I remember thinking at the time. And I attributed this to their inability to consume large quantities of alcohol and remain sensible like I could. And the bartender walked over and said, "Sir, what were you speaking?" And I said, "Well, German, of course." And he said, "Well, they were speaking Polish." I mean, I don't know, at that moment, we had these moments of clarity, and at that moment I was crushed. I've come to this. I remember walking out on the sidewalk, standing out on 8th Avenue in New York City, and I felt tears running down my face. And my parents were, my father was German, my mother was Swedish, and the one thing that we didn't do a lot of is hug and things. It was inappropriate behavior to show emotion at a public level. And I realized I was crying, and I felt so lost. And I felt shame because I was I was belying myself to the world. I was being vulnerable for a moment. That soon passed and I wandered on. That's sort of the way my life went. But I went ahead and got my doctorate degree, and I'm sure you're familiar with all that research. That was the perception of geomagnetism in Belgian homing pigeons. I told you you were familiar with it. Actually, if any of you have watched PBS or anything, every now and then they'll mention me on some of my research on those shows when they're talking about bird migration and navigation. I remember once I was watching it with my daughter. She was about 17 at the time. I kept mentioning this Bartell on this Discovery Channel or one of those, and she said to me, do you know him? And I said, I used to. I didn't tell her it was me, because I'd come so far down. But I graduated with that doctorate, and what did I do? What should I do? Well, I went to college. I did a postdoctoral at Oxford for 2 years, and I had put on a lecture every 3 months and entertained them with this, what they called a brass instrument type scientific approach to psychology. And I enjoyed that. But there came that time when society, no matter how many gold stars I'd achieved, expects you to go out and get a job. It was as if I'd gotten a telegram from my parents saying, get a job. And so what was I to do? I looked around, I added up all of my assets and tried to determine what I could do best. And it came down and I found that I was qualified for one of two things. I could either sell used cars, which is nothing wrong with that, it's an honorable profession, or I could teach. And somehow I thought that teaching had a little bit more clout to it, so I opted to teach. And in the academic world, you don't prepare a resume, you prepare a curriculum vitae. And I listed all these things I'd published and all this, and I came back and went to a couple of professional meetings in the American Psychological Association, and I let all those lucky universities out there know that I was available. And that's literally the way I thought about it. And I was granted 5 interviews to go join certain departments, and I would go and interview with these. And I remember my first one was a university you might have heard of. It was called Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama. Auburn didn't have an airport, and I found out that the closest place I'd get there was a town called Columbus, Georgia. And I flew into Columbus, Georgia, and rented a car, drove over to Auburn, and I was to be there the next morning on a Friday morning at 8 o'clock, and I showed up at the chairman's office. And little did I know that they had arranged a stress interview for me that day. It was someone in the department's bright idea, probably someone teaching industrial psych. And he said, well, how did you find us? And I said, well, you were on the map. He says, well, you're teaching a class in 5 minutes. You know, without preparation, I'm going to go teach this class cold. Well, that was fine. And I followed down the thing, and when I got in there, it was all the graduate students and the entire faculty. And I thought, well, this is a setup. I was game for it. I love things like that, challenges. And I got up there and told them more about bar pressing behavior and the effect of radiation on it than they cared to know, I think. But I filled that hour, and it went on the rest of the day. I had about 3 classes to teach, and I had to go into the lab and hook some equipment up. They wanted to see if I was proficient in this. It really put me through the ringer. And I remember lunch. It was a greasy sandwich and pre-sweetened iced tea, and I don't like pre-sweetened iced tea. I like straight iced tea. The little things like that, it's interesting, that stand out and you remember. And finally, it was 5 o'clock. All the faculty meet back in the chairman's office, and he's going on about Auburn, Alabama, and he says, you know, the azaleas are in bloom. He says, it's a lovely community. Would you like to go out and see the neighborhood and everything? And, or would you rather go to my house and have a cocktail? Some choice. Not surprisingly, I opted for a cocktail. My drinking at that point throughout my college years from high school on had just increased so gradually and become such a part of my life that I thought it was a part of everybody's life. And I knew that I enjoyed drinking and that I did it on a daily basis, but I hadn't lost control, I didn't think. I'd go to his house,
And, you know, we don't really notice how other people drink. And after my third cocktail, one of these gentlemen said, "You know, we're proud of one thing here in Auburn." By this time, I'm regaling them with my theoretical position on personality theory and emotion and motivation and all this carrying on. And he says, "We do not sell alcoholic beverages within a mile of the campus." Well, scratch Auburn. Little things like that were already making major life decisions for me. I literally got up and excused myself and got in that car and drove back to Columbus, Georgia, and took the first available flight out. You know, my next interview was at the University of Washington in Seattle, and that was nice. And then I went down, I had an interview at Berkeley. I want to tell you, this is 1967, and Berkeley was happening. You know, I was right in the middle of it. It was interesting. And then I had an interview at the University of Southern California. I almost signed a contract to teach there. But I had one last, you know, and with as high esteem I held myself in, I knew that they'd be disappointed if I didn't show up for the interview. And I got on a plane, I flew in and landed at a place called Moisant Airport. And that's the New Orleans International Airport. Went in to interview at Tulane. They didn't even tell me what time to be there. I showed up about 10. Had to check out the French Quarter the night before. And I go in there laid back, and one of them said, let's go have lunch. And we went over to the faculty dining room, and I noticed that on the tables there were carafes of wine. And I said, "Oh, you have wine on the table?" And he said, "Oh, yes, that's just one of the perks. There's no charge for that." And I thought, I have found civilization. These people know how to teach psychology. 1 o'clock that afternoon, I signed a contract to teach Tulane University. I would have liked to have said that I spent the rest of my years there in New Orleans being successful, gathering gold stars and publishing, but it didn't work out that way for me. I moved my family down, and we got all ensconced and settled there. And I started out teaching, and I loved it. I had to teach 9 hours a semester as an assistant professor. I scheduled all my courses for Tuesday and Thursday, and the rest of the time I was going to have for my research. And that was my plan. It just didn't work out that way. Turns out that most of my research was done from barstool to barstool. They make it very convenient to drink in New Orleans. You know, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. One time I calculated out the number of registered liquor permits in that city, and there's one for every 340 men, women, and children. Just, they're cheap, and all you need is a place, and you can open up a bar. Actually, the property values increase with proximity to the neighborhood bar. You know, it's just a different way of life. I taught there for 3 years, and I tried to do research. I didn't publish a single thing. And I went in to see the chairman, and I said, "It's getting difficult for me for some reason to make these morning classes, and I would like to take a sabbatical. My research has slowed down quite a bit. I'd like to take a sabbatical for a year and just concentrate on the research." And I was serious. I deluded myself into believing it. And he said, "Well, you haven't been on the staff long enough to have a sabbatical with pay." And I said, "Oh, I don't want money. I just want to use your facilities, your laboratories, and I want to really get in." And so they granted that, I think with some relief. And our research centered solely on drinking from that point on. I never went back to teach again, something that I love so much. I have never gotten another paycheck since that time. That was the only period in my life where I ever earned a paycheck. I'm not proud of that, not at all. By 1973, my wife walked in one day. Had the big house on the hill, but my wife walked in and said, had a guy that, rest of my life I made investments and things like that, remarkably lucky. He owned an FM station I owned an FM station where he was a general manager. And they walked in hand and said, "We're taking the children and leaving, we're in love." And I had no idea, it was just boom out of And being the old psychologist, I tried to play psychologist once again. I said, let's be adult about this. Let's sit down and talk. I remember I never saw my parents have an argument. They would sit down and discuss things. And so this was my model. And I sat down and I said, well, I'd suggest rather than doing something this rash, that what we need is a trial separation. Doesn't that sound adult? I said, I'll move out tomorrow and we'll wait 6 months and see how things work out. Well, I moved out and got an apartment. And 48 hours later, there was a knock at the door early in the morning and I was hit with desertion papers. Well, I went ballistic. You know, I hadn't deserted. What made me mad was in order to get these papers in the pipeline and channel, they had to have predicted this about 2 weeks before. In fact, the date was before I moved out on these papers. And they had predicted my behavior so well, they knew exactly what I was going to do. And I was furious at that. Not the fact that they were running off together, but that they had... And that started things out. I remember I did the only logical thing that a person could do like that. I went to Hong Kong. I don't know, it just made sense at the time. All my life I was just going places and doing things and running away. And I could enable myself to do those things because money wasn't a problem. I told this attorney that was representing me as I was leaving, I said, look, pay anything you want in alimony, because I'm business oriented and I knew that that was a deductible. And I said, but keep the child support to a bare minimum. Well, I show back up in New Orleans and he says, well, I've got good news for you. He says, your alimony's zero and your child support's $1,000 per child. And that was quite a bit in child support back then, so I thought, well, okay. And that's not deductible. That's just cream off the top. I remember writing those checks out all those years, you know, as my children, my youngest at the time of the divorce was 11. And I wrote the checks out, and finally my son turned 18. And the month that my daughter was to turn 18, my wife showed up, and she said, I want you to forget that final check. I said, oh, no, I'm going to pay it. She said, no, you've been such a brick about all this. And I thought, you know, she wants that excuse to be able to say, you know, that son didn't pay all of his child support. I wrote that check out and handed it to her and felt so smug and good as she left the room and left. And my daughter looked up at me and said, Dad, you know, we've been living with you all this time. It never dawned on me to go back to get things set. I'd been supporting my husband-in-law all those years, you know. But that's how manageable my life was. Well, my children eventually went away to college, and I was free to do pretty much what I wanted. And it was getting difficult for me to do just minimal things like pay phone bills and light bills and things like that. It was getting awkward, and I couldn't keep up with time. And so by this time, I'd hired a social secretary, and I had a maid, and I had all this sort of thing, and I hired enablers. At one time, I had as many as five working for me. And it was their job to get me on and off of airplanes and to where I was supposed to be and to tell me whether it was night or morning or just little details like that. I didn't know what they were. The treatment centers told me that they were enablers. I didn't know what they were, but I call them personal assistants and things like that. And I drank that way. I think I drank alcoholically for probably 18 years. You know, when I meet some guy that comes into the program that is about 10 years younger than me, and he says, and I've got 45 years of sobriety, I think, boy, you wimp. I was out there fighting a good battle till it drove me to my knees. But I drank like that in a crowd and a fog, and at the height of my drinking, I was maintaining a residence in New York City, and one in London, and one in Hong Kong. One in San Francisco and one in New Orleans. And I thought that I was a jet setter. And I thought the world envied me. And I didn't know that they pitied me. I knew a lot of important people, but they would, if we'd run into each other in an airport, they always had some place to go or something to do. You know, it just never dawned on me how pathetic I was. And I consumed large quantities of alcohol until it came to the point where I couldn't even be loaded on and off of airplanes anymore. My neighbors were quitting me right and left, even though I let them steal as much as they wanted and paid them handsomely. I couldn't even keep them in my employ. I became so disgusting and had no idea. I did most of my drinking in the bar rooms and lounges and resorts, and somehow if you drink Chateau Lafite Rothschild, you're not a wino. You know? And I used to go through a case of that a week. But the last 2 years of my drinking, I drank alone, I drank in my house, I'd given up all my other residences. I tried to simplify my life as much as possible. I wasn't out drinking, and it just wasn't any fun, but I had no other answer. Nothing else I could do. It wasn't all bad. I used to have a lot. I never got a DWI or anything like that. Never once. I didn't drive a car. My attorneys, early on, when they saw the direction my life was taking, said, "You cannot drive a car. We advise you to get drivers." So I had drivers usually. So I never got it. I would sometimes take a car and go someplace, but if I had a drink, I'd just leave it. And I remember one time I walked into a bar on Royal Street, and I used to always have that solution. If I couldn't get home, I'd go to a hotel. And that was always my solution. The next morning I could find the car because I'd park it in some garage, and I could went in on Royal Street and hand this guy my garage receipt, and I said, "I'm having trouble finding my car. Can you find it?" And he looked at it. He says, "Yeah, Charlie." I said, "Well, where is it?" And he said, "San Francisco." You know, that didn't even make sense to me at the time, and later it turned out that I'd rented a car in San Francisco, left it in the parking garage, and it was just clacking out on American Express, and everybody was happy but me. Had been there 6 months. Another job for their neighbors. But the last year of drinking was that time when I'd already crossed through years before that magic plane called alcoholism. But I reached that point where it was just disgusting, and all I was doing was trying to maintain some semblance of sanity. And I was just compulsively drinking, and I would wake up and I would drink 24 hours a day. And I would wake up and I wouldn't know if it was twilight, I wouldn't know whether it was dawn or dusk. And I would try to calculate it out, and I just, all that became irrelevant. The last year of my drinking, I made a fatal mistake. I stopped eating. My normal body weight, I weighed 195 pounds when I graduated from high school. And I was actually an inch and a half taller than I am now, too. I don't know what happened. I took such good care of myself. That last year of eating, last year of drinking, I just stopped eating. Food would be prepared for me, and the maid stuck with me all that time, and I would try to eat it, but I'd just, two or three bites, food became unpalatable. The only thing I could do was take mainly Jack Daniel's whiskey to get any caloric intake, and of course those are empty calories. And I realized when I'd look in the mirror that I'm losing a little weight. You know, I'm looking a little peaked. I can understand today why people with bulimia and anorexia, how a lot of these young ladies would look and think they're fat. I would think, well, if I eat Saturday, I'll just blow back up. I just have no problem. I started having trouble with my balance. I'd be walking across the parking lot, and all of a sudden I'd stop abruptly. And I'd say, well, I've bumped into a wall. And I'd try to back away from that wall, and I couldn't do it. And I'd be laying flat on my face. And I have no idea I'd fallen. I've spent a lot of time in emergency rooms getting sewed up and things like this, you know. Eventually, that last 6 months, I just stayed at home and just drank. And I woke up on a morning on December the 5th, 1987, and I knew something was wrong because I couldn't feel my feet and I couldn't feel my legs. And I tried to get out of bed and I couldn't. And I realized I was paralyzed. And I panicked because how am I going to get to a drink? And I knew that it was 6:30, but I didn't know whether it was evening or morning. There was digital clocks sitting there. Didn't tell me whether it was a.m. or p.m. And I couldn't get to a drink. And I realized my sympathetic nervous system is shutting down. I'm dying and I can't get to a drink. But that was finally a solution, death. I looked over on the nightstand and there was a half full glass from the night before, thank God. I reached and grabbed that glass and I fastidiously removed the cigarette butt that was in it. And I drank that drink down. And to this day, that's the last drink of alcohol I've had. I hope and pray it's my last. All dependent upon the maintenance of a spiritual program of Alcoholics Anonymous. About that time, I heard the back door open. I thought, oh, great, it's the maid. And I don't want to cry out and appear pitiful to her, so I just wait as patiently as I can. And eventually, she comes in the bedroom and says, oh, you're in bed. I said, no, that's all right. I said, I've decided to stay in bed all day today. I don't have anything to do. And she looked a little bit funny and she said, well, can I get you something? And I said, yes, I'd like two quarts of Jack Daniels. Just set them on the nightstand, please. And you see, I'd calculated. I thought probably a half or maybe one quart would kill me. I knew I was shutting down. But I wanted that backup. Happiness is a backup, just in case. And I was going to drink to death. And she left the room and I was trying to be patient, but I kept noticing that clock. 15 minutes went by, 20 minutes went by. At 30 minutes, she walked back in. She had those two bottles, and she sat them down. By this time, I'm feeling awfully weak, and I'm worrying about they were both capped, and I didn't know whether I could open them. I didn't want her to know that I was in any distress. So I thought, when she leaves the room, I can crack the top on one of them and start drinking. And then I hear noise at the back door, and eventually, coming into my room with my son and daughter, who I hadn't seen in about 4 months at that stage. Not because I hadn't wanted to see them, but they didn't want to see me. My son looked down at me with great scorn, and he said, get out of bed, we're taking you to a hospital. And I said, what for? December the 5th was a Friday. He says, we think that you're having a problem with alcohol. Boy, that galled me. I'm having a problem. I can't get the damn lid off of this thing. And I said, look, it's Friday. I promise to go in Monday. Does that sound? I promise you I'll go in Monday. But the doctors are arranging for their golf games and everything. He says, no, you're going in right now. And I look at those two bottles and I think, they're not going to let me take those to the hospital. He said, get out of bed, and I started crying. Once again, something I'd been trained not to do. I'd never cried in front of my children. And I feel this enormous shame. You see, I'd also wet the bed, and I didn't want my children to see that. Remember, he walked over and he told my daughter, he said, pack him some things, and he ripped those covers back and he picked me up like a rag doll effortlessly. I marveled at his strength. Took me out and threw me in the back of this car. Trundled me off to the hospital. They get me checked in. You know how the procedures checking you in the hospital are all involved. They gotta weigh you and take your blood pressure and check your credit. All those things. All those medical procedures that are so important. I can't stand on the scales, and they've got me in one of these sling affairs that it's actually from the morgue, it's what they weigh bodies with. And they got me cranked up there, and the nurse calls out, he weighs 105 pounds. And I started arguing. I said, that's absolutely ridiculous. You've got to check your scale. I might have lost a few pounds, but I weigh 195 pounds. And she is 105 pounds. And then I remember being sort of pummeled around, and next thing I know, my doctor comes in, and she's a neighbor of mine. And she comes in and says, Charles, I've been talking it over with your children, and we think we're going to transfer you to a treatment facility a rehabilitation center for alcoholism. I said, oh, that's not necessary. If you want me to stop drinking, I'll stop drinking. Because the first thing that flashed through my mind were those two bottles of Jack Daniels. I had to get to them. I said, why don't you prescribe, what's that pill? She said, Antabuse. I said, yeah, give me some Antabuse. I'll take that and you won't have to worry about me. No intention of swallowing that stuff. And she says, no, she says, we've talked this over. We don't think you have a choice in this matter. I thought, oh, gee, what a bitch she's being. I thought, well, I'll go along with this. I'll escape from the other place. You know, I got those two bottles of Jack Daniels. And I said, well, at least one thing you can do is let me have a good night's sleep. We'll talk about it in the morning. She said, oh, how long have you been here, Charles? And I said, 4 or 5 hours. She says, you've been here 10 days. Ooh. Took a little wind out of my argument, you know. Just the logic just fell off the edge of the world, and I thought, well, I'll just go along. So I go to this treatment center, transferred to another hospital, and I go in style, man. I'm carried in on a stretcher. And they put me in a thing that you folks call detox. Now, I've been in a hospital for 10 days, you know. What does it take for medical detox? 3 to 5 hours. The problem was my vital signs were all over the place. I was dying. That's very poor form. Hospitals will never forgive you for dying on the premises, you know. It just throws all their records out of kilter and makes them look bad. One hospital forces them off on this other hospital, and I'm in that detox 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, 20 days. I'm still in detox, but I'm making progress, by God. I'm in a wheelchair. I am mobile, and I am contemplating escape because I've got these two bottles of Jack Daniels at home, you see. I already found out that the doors are locked, but I'm mobile. Watch out for me. So I've been there 30 days, and I didn't know what was going on. I just knew a lot about detox. And they couldn't stabilize my life signs. Unfortunately, they didn't tell me. If they told me you were dying, I'd have probably just didn't want to be in any trouble. You know, I'd just roll over and die. But they decided to take me to a thing called a group, and I had to meet a counselor for this. Let me tell you about chips on shoulders from PhDs in psychology. They're going to take me down there, some guy with a master's degree in counseling, you know. I was rude. But they rolled me down this long corridor, and this guy would have made Dennis look small. He was a former linebacker in the NFL. Biggest black man I'd ever seen. I thought, oh, I better change my tactics here. They roll me in there, and I'm trying to maintain some semblance of dignity. And he says, well, how would you describe your drinking, Charles? I said, well, I admit I'm a heavy social drinker. He says, oh, really? He says, how much do you drink a day? I thought, oh, he's trying to be subtle, trying to catch me. And I thought the only way I could convince him that I wasn't an alcoholic, because it was apparent to me he had a narrow mind, as narrow as my doctor's mind, about my problem, I'd tell him what I had to maintain on. If I wanted to maintain, if I had to go to the bank and do some business or a broker or something like that, I would space myself out in a 24-hour period and I'd consume 1 quart of Jack Daniels. That way I could appear straight to people. At least I thought it was straight. I never got a buzz on or anything. I just felt that sort of neutral feeling, coasting. And I thought, you know, he's so narrow-minded, if I tell him I drink a quart a day, he might think I'm an alcoholic. So I said, only about 2 pints a day. Technically, that wasn't lying, but it sounded like less to me than a whole quart a day. And sure enough, he was narrow-minded. He said, we think you got a problem with alcohol. I thought, oh, gee. So I started in to being rehabilitated. And that can be a pretty boring process, particularly when I find out later that he'd drawn the short straw and got the cocky psychologist for his group. And they sort of would wheel me in and put me in the corner, and y'all would have a great time. I was making some progress. I went to a physical therapy while I was there, and those people taught me some wonderful things. I still can't feel my feet very well. And I can't, if the lights go off and it's black, I'll fall. I can't maintain balance because I have to use visual cues to maintain my balance. I've just learned to live with it. I've never been happy in my life either. You know. I've also rocketed back up. I drank Ensure Plus for a year, and 3 times a day, and force-fed myself, and I've rocketed up. Watch out, I weigh 150 pounds now. I'd like to do some serious damage. But I graduated to a walker. When I eventually left that hospital, I left with a cane. Just still prideful as hell. That walker looked, it wasn't very streamlined. But I was mobile. And I was in there week in, week out, week in, week out. And it went the same way each time. I would go every Friday, and then say, the head of the therapy there would say, Charles, we've had a meeting. We think you're making remarkable progress, but we think you can profit from another week's treatment. And by the way, you owe $11,207. And I'd write him a check. After I'd been there 58 days, one of the substance abuse technicians said, Charles, you like it here? I said, no. I got 2 bottles of Jack Daniels. But he said, you keep writing those checks, you'll be here for the rest of your life. And next Friday, I went up there to the desk, and he says, we think you're making a remarkable progress, but that you can profit from another week's treatment. And by the way, you owe, gave me the amount. And I said, I'm certainly looking forward to that extra week, but the bank is dry. I'm absolutely broke. I cannot pay you. And he said, well, we'll see. The next morning, I graduated with high honors and got my final gold star. There are a lot of great treatment centers. I think a lot of them are the halfway houses that do just wonderful work. I think, too, that somehow AA made a big mistake when it abrogated a lot of our 12-step work to those folks. I don't shed many tears over some that have shut down. This particular treatment center, eventually when the insurance money dried up, they dried up, too. But they did some wonderful things for me while I was there, even a poor one like this or a greedy one like this. They introduced me to a fellowship that was so remarkable. And called Alcoholics Anonymous. And these people would come in and take their time and come in and talk to us. And later, they'd load us in a van and they'd put my wheelchair in the back and the patients would get me in that thing and we'd go out and we'd go to these little rooms around the thing where they had these meetings. And I just thought it was splendid. I'd get so excited about how gullible you folks were and how you would accept this sort of thing. You see, my parents were extremely, extremely religious. And when I'd look at those 12 steps, it just wasn't for me. I wasn't included in that. I knew it would work for you folks, but it wouldn't work for me. See, my parents' religion was atheism. Not unusual for certain geologists and scientists. And to them, we lived in a very scientific cause and effect world, and there wasn't any room for magic. And that's what they considered religion being, sort of a base superstition that was all right for the common folk, but certainly didn't fit our elk. And I remember in high school once I went to a thing called an MYF, a Methodist Youth Fellowship. I went with a friend of mine and had a good time, and I got home and told him where I'd been, and I was grounded because that was not appropriate behavior for us. And so when I read those steps and saw God as you understand him, I said, well, that's all right for you, but that just leaves me out. You see, the word God itself had no emotional meaning to me, none at all. It may be even a little negative, but I considered myself agnostic. It just was irrelevant. I lived in a lawful universe, and it was all right for you, and I could understand that. But I didn't have any place to go except to those meetings, and they loaded me up and took me. And I'd get those warm and fuzzy feelings, and I loved your laughter. And I saw the sparkle in your eyes. I really did. And I knew mine were dull. It's fine for you. Another thing they insisted I get a sponsor. Well, I had an old boy that came up there and he made a little talk and he had gotten his master's from Harvard, so I figured he was good enough for me. and I asked him to sponsor me for all the wrong reasons, and he accepted for all the right reasons. So that morning I graduated, I'm thinking, well, I'll go to those two Bibles, and I might have bought myself a little insurance. I might be able to get through almost both of them. I might be able to live for 36 hours before it kills me. But it was the only solution I had. I turned my back, and contempt prior to investigation, I didn't think the program was for me. It was wonderful for you, but I wouldn't fit in. I'm getting ready to leave. Who shows up but my sponsor? And I got that first step too. Get in the car. So I got in the car. And it was a long day. We made three meetings that day, and he had things he had to do. And he took me by this thing that they called a central office. And he was getting this and that and the other and making sure I'm going to read this and that and the other. And finally get home that night. And I'm honestly, I hadn't been from that morning to that night. He gets me in there, and he says, I'll see you in the morning. And I said, fine, I want to go to bed right now. Close the door. And I went in there to get those two bottles of Jack Daniels. And I had been robbed. They were not there. Disgusted I was. And I started rummaging through that, but I physically was exhausted. I couldn't find any liquor anyplace. Someone had cleaned me out. So I went to bed. I thought I'd get some in the morning. There's no way I can do it tonight. Well, it's 7:30 in the morning. Back door bell rings. Who can that be? And I sort of get up and I stumble out there. Get dressed, get in the car. And it went that way. You see, I had, by this time, I had almost coming up on 3 months of sobriety. And, well, dry, not sobriety. And because I'd been in a protected environment all that time. And Sky was saying to it, my sponsor, that I was going to stay sober. And he somehow intuited, knew everything I was going to do. And I would say, well, Sky, I'm going to work these steps. And I was ripping them off like merit badges, meant the same thing to me. I told him I had a little trouble with God, and he said, well, make the group your God. And I was resentful of that. I said, I could understand the logic. 10 of you could pick a table up effortlessly where I couldn't budget. You know, I knew you were more powerful as a group. But you had this God that was a mystical thing. Could stop time, could create worlds. And what did I have? I had you. You know, I felt like I was getting gypped. I wanted that magic God. I just couldn't buy that. But the days went on. I had 90 days. I had 4 months. I had 5 months. Hadn't had a drink. It was always getting a car. Sky was with me all the time. And gave me things to do that I thought were important. I realized that I had to do them because I was just that much quicker than you poor folks. I got to clean ashtrays. I did a good job on that. When I gave that job to someone else, I was resentful. He didn't do it as good as I did. All this. It finally came to this time, and I tell you, I've got this eidetic imagery. I'd read every conference-approved pamphlet and all the books. And I'd sit in those rooms and those discussion meetings. I couldn't wait. Finally, they'd call on me if they made that mistake. I'd give them two or three paragraphs out of each book and sit back. You know, I speak French and German and English. At least I've got a reading knowledge of all three. And but I didn't speak fluent AA. But I'd pop this thing off and give them something from, pass it on, hit them with a little AA comes of age. And they'd look at me and say, well, just keep coming back. I thought you meant it. I didn't speak AA. I didn't know what that meant. Well, I kept coming back. I knew that I would never be one of you. It wouldn't work. I knew inevitably I was going to drink. But what I was doing was just exercising this willpower and being very happy that I could get through with this thing and that I was buying that insurance. I might get a whole week before I die. It finally came that time I went to this meeting called the 449 meeting. It meets on the west bank of the Mississippi
right across from the French Quarter.
I go in there, and it's a discussion meeting, and they have a moderator there, like a chair here, but the moderator picks a topic, and they discuss it, and the topic that night was the higher power. And I don't know whether you hear yourselves, because you've lived with us all your life, but you'd say, my higher power, whom I choose to call God. I mean, you've heard that. Whom I choose to call God. It's like, if you call it anything else, you're some kind of ninny. And I'm getting angry there, and then it's just, calls on Mary, my higher power, whom I choose to call Jesus. I'm thinking, whoa, and you're my higher power, and I'm getting disgusted with you. And finally it came time for me to share, and I was hurt. I just passed. I've never passed before, you know, I wouldn't dare, but I passed that night. I didn't think the meeting would ever get over. And finally it was over. And I always liked the meeting after the meeting. I do pie and coffee well. And they said, come on, Charles, let's go by Shoney's. And I said, no, I'm a little tired. See, I had this 5 months of sobriety, and I had to reward myself. They don't have a 5-month chip. I don't know. And I bought a white Fleetwood Cadillac that day. So, you know, it's 5 months. You got to do something. I mean, my value system was so warped, you cannot imagine. And I said, no, I can't. I said, well, we're going to Shoney's if you change your mind. And I get in that car, and I think, you know, I do. The car's nice, but I've never liked General Motors products. Well, I don't know why I even bought this thing. And I said, but I owe myself something. And I said, well, I tell you what, I'll go over to the French Quarter, go to a nice restaurant, kick back, and have a real nice meal. And I'll come home. I got in that thing, and I had to go get on the Greater New Orleans Bridge to get back to the East Bank. And I'm climbing up that bridge ramp. I'm going up, and all of a sudden, I hear this voice, just as loud as you can imagine. And the voice said, 49. And I'm wondering what the bridge police are saying. 49, what does this mean? I look in my rearview mirror, and there's nothing there. I thought it was a loudspeaker on one of these police cars. So I continue on, and about 200 yards later, it's 2.5 miles across that bridge. About 200 yards later, I hear it again, but not as loud. It says 49. And I think, I'm having an auditory hallucination. And cold sweat pours out on me, and I said, but if you're having a hallucination, what's the relevance of 49? And it's one of those things you couldn't get out of your mind, but I'm getting excited. And I feel just some kind of intense excitement. And I take the first exit off the bridge there, and that's Camp Street. Very symbolic, because that's a street where all the winos lived. And I'm going down Camp Street, and I'm excited. And suddenly the colors seem brighter to me. And New Orleans is a 24-hour town, and the downtown's active all the time. You know, people live down there still. And there are a lot of people on the street. And I look up ahead of me, and there's Canal Street, and then I've got to cross that. And all the names changed to the French, and I'll be in the quarter. But I look up ahead, and there's a Sheraton Hotel standing there like this big phallic symbol. And a solution came to me. I said, I will just get a room, like when I used to drink. I'll just get a room. I'll order up room service. I'm a little tired. I was everything at that little pamphlet, that little booklet, Living Sober said, halt, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I'll order up room service, get something to eat, watch a little TV, drift off. I'll go home in the morning and everything will be fine. Finally get to Canal Street, and there are people moving back and forth, and it's about 9 o'clock now, 9:15. I hook a right, I have to go a half a block, drive into the drive-in registration. Guy comes out, the valet Parker, gives me a key and says, checking in? I said, yes. And so I gave him a $20 bill, I remember that. Said, take good care of the car. I walked through the side entrance there, the big old door, and I walk in this huge lobby, and off to the left is the registration area, and it's all mahogany and brass, and then there's sitting areas with the big leather overstuffed chairs and the oriental rugs, and up there in the mezzanine level there's a pod, and they've got one of these big Yamaha grand pianos that plays the disc, and I swear it was Gershwin himself, and Rhapsody in Blue was playing. And off to the right is this huge atrium, and there was a bar. And there had to be about 200 people in there. And it's completely open. And the gaiety and the laughter was so wonderful. And I could hear the ice tinkle in those glasses, and it sounded like fine barbarian crystal. And at that instant, I remembered what 49 was. $49 was the cost of a liter of Jack Daniels at any Sheraton International Hotel at that time, room service. And I knew what was happening. It wasn't when this is going to happen, it was now. I was relapsing. And I remember what it said in the big book. Now, I used to talk to Sky about it, my sponsor, and I'd say, what does it mean, Sky, when it says redouble your spiritual efforts at the moment of relapse? And he says, it means pray your rear off. Well, I took that to mean I had to contact my higher power. Well, that would be difficult. My higher power is having coffee and pie at Shoney's across the river. And so I did something that someone had suggested. I decided to use your higher power. He said I could borrow your God anytime you wanted. And I said, well, I'll just borrow this God. I had to go through that little ritual to justify my relapse. And I said a prayer. I'd like to think it was as elegant as the alcoholic prayer, which is, please help me. Or something as noble as the Serenity Prayer. I'd said the Serenity Prayer and I'd said the Lord's Prayer, but I did it so I wouldn't stand out. They were just words to me. Didn't mean a thing. So I said the first real prayer in my life. I wish it had been something noble, but I'll tell you exactly what I said. And I said it at the top of my voice and people turned around and looked at me. I said, all right, God, if you exist, you'll stop me. The prayer of a spoiled brat. Spoiled child. And for an instant there, I knew some fear. I thought something as important as me, the ground was going to open and swallow me. This golden bolt of lightning would strike me down, and nothing happened. And I said, you see? And it was like the yoke of responsibility had been lifted from my shoulders. I didn't have to worry. The decision was made. I was relapsing. I was going to enjoy my Jack Daniels, and I was going to drift off, and I wouldn't be any trouble to my children or any trouble to you folks. I'd be gone. I strode across that lobby like I owned it, and I was ready for them. And they had a line there in the velvet ropes, and I'm thinking, that's 9:15, what's the problem here? And I'm waiting, getting impatient. Finally, there were three people registering, and this little gal looked up, and she had that sort of hair matted to the forehead look, and she wasn't happy, and she said, next. And I went up there and I was ready and I threw down not a green and a gold but a platinum American Express and I laid a gold Sheraton Preferred on top of that and said I want a room on the 42nd floor. See, the 42nd floor was the floor of all suites. When I'd crash at the Sheraton, I'd always work. And they had a private bar to keep you riffraff out of there, you know, just for us folks on the 42nd floor. Had a little person that would serve our drinks to us. And she looked up sort of puzzled, and she said, sir, and I said, I want a room on the 42nd floor. And she said, do you have a reservation? I said, no, but those are my credentials. And then she said these words. She said, I don't know who you think you are, but there's no room at the inn. Any time before, if someone had said that, that wouldn't have meant anything to me. But at that instant, my perception, there's no room at the inn. A feeling came over me of warmth and contentment, and I didn't know what to call it. It was later that Sky suggested that it was the grace of God. And I looked at her and I said, you know what? And she said, what? And I said, there's a higher power and his name is God. And she reached down and picked up that house phone and says, give me security, I got a live one at the front desk. I grabbed those credit cards and I beat a hasty retreat and they were just getting ready to park my car and I gave him another $20. I want you to know that was my last overt alcoholic behavioral thing that I can remember. I've learned to be as tight as rescues. That's not true. You're the most giving, free people I've ever met in my life and have been a privilege to associate with. I went back when they were working on about their third cup of coffee Saddle in there at Shoney's, feeling awfully smug and good. Didn't say anything to anybody. Didn't tell anybody that this had happened, and it was just the most remarkable thing. I was so full of contentment and happiness, and I couldn't say anything without just breaking into tears. I was so happy. After 2 days, I told my sponsor, Sky, about this. I knew I was going to get an attaboy and a gold star, and he said to me, I wouldn't tell anybody about that for a while if I were you. He said, we got work to do. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you might really try working the steps now. And we took steps 1, 2, and 3. Took 3 on my knees. Had to get Scott to help me up. I still have problems. When I get on my knees, I have to climb back up. He told me, why don't you use the stairs if you get on your knees from now on? It works fine. And all of a sudden, it all made sense to me. And I was content. I'm going over. I'm so far. Sky died when I had 9 months of sobriety. And before he died, he wasn't sick. Never sick. He just had me. He said, you know, if anything ever happens to me, you've got 24 hours to get a sponsor. I said, well, nothing's going to happen. He said, if it does. And I said, well, why? And he says, because you can't make it on your own. You need a sponsor. He got me active in the service, cleaning ashtrays had worked before, and I got very active in service. And next thing I knew, I was serving on committees, and before you knew it, I was a GSR, and at least I could spell it. In the DCM, I was chairman of the New Orleans Service Assembly. And interestingly enough, in 1995, I found myself in a hotel room at the opening of the conference in New York. Randy S. was up there at that time, serving his 3rd year. And I was a delegate from Panel 45, Area 27, Louisiana. I remember trying to sleep that night, and I was tossing and turning, and about 3 o'clock, I sat bolt upright, and I prayed to God not let me screw this thing up. And I apologized to God. I said, this beautiful fellowship is much larger than one person, and I couldn't affect it one way or the other. Just let me know your will. And I fell right to sleep. From that time on, never had any trouble. I've been so privileged to be allowed to serve you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been such a pleasure. One of the things I had to do was go to San Diego to the International Tough Work in it. And they asked me to speak on, of all things, humility. Well, we're not all perfect, are we? Making progress. But so many exciting things have happened over time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, there are things that we call coincidences that we all look at each other and say, it's a God thing, isn't it? I've seen 2 atheists say, it's a God thing. The other says, yeah, I think it is. I don't know what they mean by that, but they know what they mean. Interesting, the hotel I was staying in was this 2-towered Holiday Inn. And like 1,000 rooms, and they had a lot of the foreign delegations were there. And they didn't understand those smoking laws out there. And they'd light up in the lobby, and the manager would go freak out on them. And they'd threaten this and that. And so finally they opened a room up about half this size, just off the lobby, and said, if you go in there and smoke, we won't bother you. And they hustled and didn't even have ashtrays. They got some old carrot and pecans and put some sand in it and had those sitting around. And they had some folding chairs. And after a while, everybody was meeting in there. Well, you know, the International assumes all this importance, but it's just Friday evening, Saturday, Sunday at noon, it's over. And you'd think, gosh, after all this planning in 5 years, I want it to last longer, but it doesn't. So Sunday afternoon, people are sort of milling around in there, and because most people had to wait for charters on Monday, and you know, it took those of you there a couple of days to clear the town out. And someone said, I wish it wasn't over, and someone said, let's have a meeting. And we sat in a big circle, and there were about 100 or 150 people in that circle. And each person just said a few words, and it went around the room. And the first one that tried to say it in English that didn't speak English natively, she was a Belgique from Belgium, and she started trying to say something in English. Someone said, no, each in their own language. And it was so beautiful, and she started sharing in French. And as it went around, you'd hear German, and you would hear Swahili, and you would hear all these different languages. And it got there, were about 18 Japanese sitting all together in a row. And they started sharing, and every now and then I would hear a word, and I'd think, that word is sobriety. They'd say, sobriety. Very difficult for them to say, but they'd... And you could, when you couldn't understand the languages, you could understand pain and you could understand happiness. And it all ended up with a solution, all with a happiness. And it finally got around and the meeting was over and everybody got up and hugged, and this whole process had lasted about 3 hours, 3.5 hours. And no one got tired of it. It was just beautiful. I went to talk to the translator that was with the Japanese, and I said, pardon me, did I hear the word sobriety? And he got all excited and said, yes, yes, yes. We use your word. We use your word. And I said, why? He said, we don't have a word means that. And so I asked the obvious question, what does it mean? And he gave me the most beautiful definition of sobriety I've ever heard. He said, why, sober with peace, of course. Sober with peace. And that's my definition of what I've found in this program, sobriety with peace. And I wish you all sober with peace. Thank you.